This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we hear from the Michigan director of the group Enroll America on the second round of open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act. But first, why has Bob Pogue's tenure in the House of Representatives, spanning the New Deal through Watergate, received such limited scholarly attention? Robert Duke, a retired Eastern Michigan University professor with a Ph.D. from Western Michigan University, asks that question in his book, LBJ and Grassroots Federalism, Congressman Bob Pogue, Race and Change in Texas. Bob Duke, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin by talking about Congressman Bob Pogue. Why is he, as you say in this book, a footnote to history?
People in the audience today who are interested in the life and career of Lyndon Johnson might know works by Robert Caro, Robert Dallek. Many noted biographers have addressed Johnson's life. But Bob Pogue is an example of a key ally of Lyndon Johnson's who slipped through the cracks. I conclude that the reason that this happened is that while Johnson is famous for becoming a crusader for civil rights, his longtime friend and colleague in a neighboring congressional district, Bob Pogue, remained a staunch segregationist. And historians have not been spending a lot of time with the segregationists, the South's second lost cause. And we understand the reasons for that, but I found the relationship between the two men fascinating.
So as we sit here in 2014, and yes, people still talk about Lyndon Johnson. New books come out pretty regularly. We probably have not read the last historical treatment of Lyndon Johnson's presidency or his time in Congress, for that matter, and in the Senate. Why should we know more about Bob Pogue?
Well, I think what brought me to this topic was the same kind of frustration that many citizens feel. Our system simply doesn't seem to be working very well. Our political system at the federal level and state and local issues as well. And I wanted to look back at the career of Lyndon Johnson, who is noted for being able to untangle the complex webs that snag the political process so often. I wanted to look at his career, and in doing so, I needed to examine his relationship with other politicians. And I found that by concentrating on a single place, Waco, Texas, I could see the fruits of their labor best. And the book focuses on, therefore, what these two men did to bring federal resources to Waco, Texas.
And is that what you mean by grassroots federalism, as you say in the title?
One of the things that I think is a mistaken conception about the Great Society programs is that somehow or other, critics of those programs have painted a picture that everything was top down. Actually, the excessive control by the federal government is more a product of the 70s. Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue were both products of the New Deal. And one of the things that characterized those programs were local people involved in delivering federal services. When the federal government set up the National Youth Administration programs here in Kalamazoo, for example, or in Waco, Texas, these were staffed by the local citizenry. And when they set up advisory councils to determine how to spend federal resources, the decisions were made largely by the local stakeholders. I found that this is a characteristic of Lyndon Johnson's political philosophy that you can trace all the way through the Great Society. Grassroots citizen involvement.
You open this book with the story of a dedication of a dam in Waco in 1958, which, as you note, was something that was not going to necessarily live on in the history books. It was an interesting news story for that day. But why do you begin by focusing on that? What does that tell us about Lyndon Johnson, Bob Pogue, and what they were trying to do as members of Congress?
Let me give you just a little bit of the landscape of Waco, Texas first. The city was founded just below the confluence of two rivers, the Bosque River and the Brazos. And proximity to water makes a lot of sense if you're settling in Texas. But as Waco grew, a characteristic of the river systems became more and more of a problem. Those rivers flooded horribly. When the rains came, they tended to come all at once, and incredible damage. So the riverfront district in Waco was largely of marginal use. The city of Waco and leaders in that city had been trying desperately since the early 1900s to solve this problem. It wasn't until Lyndon Johnson became Senate Majority Leader and Bob Pogue was at a pinnacle of his power in the House of Representatives that they were finally able to bring the federal resources to Waco and to solve this problem. If you've been to Waco recently, you know that Baylor University has expanded enormously in recent years. There is no way they could have built their new football stadium alongside the Brazos River if Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue had not worked cooperatively with the citizens of Waco to bring that dam to the city.
So they made government work for their constituents in Texas.
Yes, and there were political rewards for that. They were elected consistently. Johnson, of course, moved up the food chain, as we all know. Bob Pogue, however, remained in Congress for 21 terms.
And became chairman of the Agriculture Committee, which, as you say, is maybe part of the reason he is not better remembered, because agriculture is not one of those areas that people look back on often and see where power was being used, etc. But he certainly did use that to his advantage and the advantage of the people he represented in Texas.
In the parlance of today's politics, he was a player at the time. John Kennedy considered Bob Pogue for the position of Secretary of Agriculture when Kennedy took the White House himself in 1961. But the job went to Orville Freeman of Minnesota instead. The Kennedy administration was not interested in fighting any battles with Congress over the appointment of a segregationist to a cabinet position.
So there was a ceiling on his career, in part because of his position on race and civil rights.
I don't think that Bob Pogue, at least judging from what he said in oral histories that I've read and from his own autobiography, I don't think that Bob Pogue ever really latched onto the idea that his stubbornness on the issue of segregation not only hurt his own career, but it hurt the city of Waco.
How so?
Let me give Exhibit A. In the 1950s, during the Cold War, one of the biggest plums that any politician could bring home to the people was a military base. And sure enough, Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue worked together to bring the 12th Air Force, as it was that division of the Air Force, was going to come to Waco at the James Connolly Air Base. And that was established in 1957. When Lyndon Johnson won his full term in the White House with the sweeping victory in November of 1964, one of the very first things he decided to do was to close that air base in Waco, Texas, and move it to Austin, Texas. Reason being, and this is very clear, and it's classic Johnson politics, Representative Jake Pickle of Austin had voted in favor of the Civil Rights Act, one of five Southern House members to do so, and Bob Pogue voted against it. So Johnson knew how to use power, and Waco paid a very high price for Bob Pogue's segregationist posture.
And that is kind of a key moment in the Johnson-Pogue relationship, isn't it, this decision with the Air Force Base?
Yes, there's no question that this was devastating to Pogue in many ways. It's not to say that his career was ruined. He continued to represent Waco for more than a decade after that. But the elites in town, the business establishment that was far more progressive on matters of race than might be commonly thought, had major problems with Pogue's handling of that matter.
I want to read from a little bit here at the end of chapter 3 in your book to get a little bit more into this issue of civil rights and race. Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue supported each other like the friends and true believers they were. But somewhere between that bluebonnet-lined highway from Austin to Waco and what activists would call the road to freedom, Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue parted company. And you go on to say that Pogue and LBJ agreed on so much, including the vital role that citizens play in shaping the destiny of the community they call home, but they differed on who could live in that community. Explain a little bit more about where this division started. Is there a starting point where we can say Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue just took separate paths?
Well, Johnson's evolution on the issue of civil rights is something that all of his biographers give attention to, rightfully so. one of the things that got me into this study in the first place was wondering, at what point could a white man in the South stand up among his peers and say, this is wrong, we cannot continue to live this way any longer? Johnson argued throughout his career, particularly once he had come out, so to speak, on civil rights, that it was all a matter of timing, that it didn't do any good to be on the cutting edge of something if you weren't in a position of power to do anything about it. By the late 50s, Johnson begins to show his hand with some legislative moves that result in some weak civil rights bills in Congress. At this point, the relationship between Pogue and Johnson isn't in danger, because I don't think that Bob Pogue, or Lyndon Johnson for that matter, imagined that history would move in such a way that it would be Lyndon Johnson that would inherit the mantle of the presidency at a time when the issue simply had to be dealt with. So I don't think this is a moment that both dreaded, a moment of truth, so to speak. I don't think it's like that. I think it's Johnson's sense of what needed to be done on a moral and just for the federal government to be able to keep peace in the country, the issue simply had to be dealt with. Pogue argued for all of his life that the problems in Waco weren't that bad and Waco could handle it on its own.
Did the different approach that Johnson and Pogue had on race and civil rights stem from the fact that while they were from neighboring congressional districts, those districts were very different in makeup and culture and those sort of things?
Here in Michigan, we're well acquainted with how different places like Metro Detroit can be from places like Harrison, Michigan, in the north central part of the state. If one hasn't been to Texas, the diversity of the state in terms of landscape and political culture and practically any measure you have is really quite extraordinary. Johnson happened to grow up in a portion of the state that was heavily settled by German immigrants and strongly anti-slavery immigrants. And so that colored much of Texas history. And Central Texas, South Central Texas in particular, is noted even today as being a unique oasis of liberalism. Think of images people have of Austin, Texas. It's thought of as the Ann Arbor of the state.
Right.
Maybe not so much anymore. But the hill country that Johnson grew up in is a place where slavery never really took root, not only because of the German settlement, but also because of just the landscape wasn't suitable for it. Pogue, however, grew up in the Blackland Prairie area of Texas, where slavery took hold pretty deeply. Pogue grew up with African-American domestics in his parents' household. Johnson experienced nothing like that. So it's geography, it's the way they were brought up, nature and nurture.
Which leads us to a very interesting point in this story of civil rights and these two longtime friends who had served in Congress together for a good chunk of their lives. Lyndon Johnson, as president, is now trying to get the votes that he needs for the Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson is known at that time and still throughout history as a man who could get people to change their minds on deep-seated issues, things where you couldn't think you could move people. And yet he never at any point goes to his friend, Bob Pogue, and tries to get him to vote for the Civil Rights Act. What was Lyndon Johnson thinking by not even making the effort?
The best I can figure, because I'm not sure that any of us can really get inside LBJ's head, but the best I can figure is that he did the math. Part of his mastery of the Senate, to use Robert Caro's characterization, is that Johnson knew how to count votes. And when he had enough, he had enough. And the situation in the House of Representatives with the Civil Rights Act was not nearly as tenuous as getting past a Senate filibuster. So the play that's gotten so much attention on Broadway, All the Way, with Bryan Cranston, focuses on Johnson's persuasion during this time. He was using every minute of every day to get that bill through Congress. He simply didn't need Bob Pogue's vote. That's what it boiled down to. He simply didn't need the vote.
perhaps showing how Lyndon Johnson is the ultimate politician, that he would not chase after a vote he didn't need, because instead he's going to go after the votes that he does need, and he's not going to worry about his personal relationship with Bob Pogue or anything else. It's get the votes that we need to get past the filibuster.
That's right. And it's interesting that at no point did Bob Pogue put two and two together and realize that he was looking over a cliff in terms of his future relationship with Lyndon Johnson. There was no indication that Pogue ever wavered on this and thought, well, wait a minute, I better support this or I'm going to be on the outs with the president.
But could Bob Pogue have also been thinking, if I do vote for the Civil Rights Act, it's going to make it really tough on me when I go back home and have to run for reelection?
That certainly proved to be the case in the South, that by the late 60s, it became harder and harder for progressive Democrats to be elected. A good, strong conservative like Bob Pogue was in good shape, though. So he knew his district well. And I'm certain that one of the reasons why he never gave serious consideration to supporting the federal action on civil rights is that just as Johnson didn't need Pogue's vote, Pogue didn't need to vote for it to stay in office.
As you said, you're someone who is looking at this through the eyes of someone from Michigan on Texas, but you have family roots in Texas. Is that part of what made you interested in this?
There's no question. My father grew up in Eddy, Texas, a small town not far from Waco, and grew up in an environment where segregation was the norm. And even though he raised his family in Chicago, I was always curious about Texas, fascinated with how attitudes about race could be in such stark contrast from one part of the country to the other. And I think it was, as a young man, efforts to figure out how could my father feel so differently about these issues than I did that led to a lot of the things I studied over the years. I've always been fascinated with Lyndon Johnson, because at some point he had the courage as a white man from Texas to stand up to his peers and say, this is wrong. We cannot function as a society on the basis of segregation.
And at the end, we see that that has created a very different Democratic Party today from the one that existed when Lyndon Johnson was president, and certainly very different from the one that was in existence when, for instance, he was Senate Majority Leader.
And there are various accounts of Johnson predicting the same to his colleagues at the time that he was pushing for this, that he was basically ruining things for the Democratic Party in the South for at least a generation, and as it turns out, longer.
To bring this back around to Bob Pogue's place in history for a moment, if he had worked with Lyndon Johnson on the issue of civil rights in the same way that he worked with him on bringing a dam to Waco, on all sorts of projects for making life better in Texas, would somebody else have written a book by now about Bob Pogue?
That's a great question. Let's put it this way. I think that there are show horses and there are workhorses. A professor I had here at Western, Chet Rogers, was the one who introduced me to that expression. And what Chet meant by that is that I think there are a lot of people in the state legislature, in city commissions, in the Congress of the United States, who are doing excellent work, but they aren't the ones who find themselves in front of the microphone all the time. I'm not sure that it was ever Bob Pogue's fate to be famous. And given his attitude on segregation, perhaps he deserves much of the time that he's spent in the shadows. But if we want any guidance on how our political system can work better today, we have to look back to a time not so far away when people with rather drastically different views on things could work together in the common interest of the public that they served. It's almost like we've lost the car keys and we can't figure out how to get back to where we once were. And I'm hoping that maybe this book will contribute to helping us find those keys again.
Bob Duke, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Bob Duke is a retired Eastern Michigan University professor. He has a PhD from Western Michigan University. His book is called LBJ and Grassroots Federalism, Congressman Bob Pogue, Race and Change in Texas. In addition to his book, Bob Duke has written a song about Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue he performed while in studio for our interview.
Gather round, Texans, the story I will tell about two politicians y'all might know pretty well. It's not John McCain and his running mate who went rogue. We're talking about Lyndon Johnson, Waco's own Bob Pogue. Now, if there's one thing Texans need, it's some Anglo from Michigan to write about Texas race and change, talk about Bob and Lyndon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Open enrollment has started again for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The group Enroll America has been urging people to get their health insurance coverage. It has operations in 11 states, including Michigan. Aaron Knott is the state director in Michigan for Enroll America. Aaron Knott, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So enrollment has already started. Open enrollment has begun. Who are the people out there in general who should be shopping right now, trying to find health insurance?
You know, we've been talking to consumers across the state and throughout Kalamazoo, and really this is an opportunity for uninsured consumers as well as people that obtained health coverage during open enrollment last year. You know, now is a good time to either get coverage for the first time or take a look at your options through the renewal process.
If someone did get insurance through that last open enrollment process, do they have to do anything, or is it just a matter of it's a good idea to check and see if you're getting the best value, or do they automatically keep that insurance that they signed up for last time?
You know, for the most part, consumers don't have to do anything because the majority of those that obtained health coverage opted to automatically renew. That being said, we're encouraging everybody that, you know, it doesn't hurt. It's a really good idea to go back onto the marketplace and take a look at your options. You know, we have twice as many plans on the marketplace. We have four more providers on the marketplace. And you might find out that there's a better plan for you and your family, or more importantly, you, upon updating your financial information, might qualify for even more financial assistance.
So more providers on the exchange would indicate that there's the possibility, at least, that there is more competition and perhaps that could lead to some better deals?
That's correct. You know, again, there are more providers on the marketplace. There are now 16. There's robust plans available here in the greater Kalamazoo area. I've been talking to folks that, you know, started window shopping before the marketplace opened on the 15th, and they were pleasantly surprised by the new options that were made available.
Is it a complex process for someone who's never done this before? Perhaps they went right from school into a job where they had health insurance. Is it at all complex to go and shop and try to find the best deal for an individual or their family when they're looking for health insurance?
Not at all. You know, the website healthcare.gov has substantially been improved since the first open enrollment period. You know, last year there were 70 screens to click through. This year it's down to 9. You know, there are mobile applications that are available for iPhones or tablets. So really, healthcare.gov took best practices learned from the first open enrollment period and applied them. But even if this, you know, seems overwhelming or scary to consumers that aren't computer savvy, you know, there's in-person assistance available throughout Kalamazoo where consumers can sit down and work with somebody that's been trained by the federal government to walk them through that process. So, you know, there is help out here. There are tons of enrollment events between now and February 15th, as well as appointments that can be scheduled, again, one-on-one kind of conversations with assisters.
Is that the sort of thing that might be typical or similar to what someone goes through with financial planning, where you sit down, talk about what your needs are, talk about what your budget is, and see what fits in those two things?
You know, I think that's a great example right there. You know, it is like sitting down with somebody, an expert, to talk about your financial goals. Again, healthcare is complicated. You know, we work with people all across the state that need some handholding. They need, you know, to understand what the difference between a premium and a copay and coinsurance is. And that's why it's so important for those consumers to connect with, you know, an expert that can walk them through the process and answer those questions that they might have.
What penalties are people looking at if they are still without health insurance in 2015?
You know, the fine this year has gone up to $325 per individual or up to 2% of their income. But, you know, when I'm talking to people, the fine really isn't a motivating, you know, indicator for why folks are taking a look at the marketplace or signing up for coverage. It really has to do with that peace of mind, knowing that if they have an accident or get sick, that they have healthcare, they have that coverage. You know, they're not going to be forced into a financial crisis or dealing with bankruptcy because they have medical bills that they cannot afford.
You mentioned earlier that there is some assistance or subsidies available for people who perhaps don't quite make it to be able to afford health insurance. What is out there and how do people find out if they qualify?
Sure. We're telling everybody, whether you're sitting down with an in-person assister or you're, you know, in front of a computer doing it on your own, to make sure that you have all your kind of personal information right there with you as you begin the process. And that includes, you know, pay stubs and the information that you would use when you file your taxes. And so what we know is last year, of the 272,000 folks that successfully enrolled in the marketplace, 87% of them qualified for financial assistance. And, you know, we know the average cost of all the plans last year, this is all the plans, was about $97, and the average tax credit was about $246. We also know that 62% of those consumers that enrolled did find a plan for $100 or less.
The Kalamazoo Gazette ran a story on November 15th, finding that there were 16,000 people in Kalamazoo County who were able to get insurance through the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare during the first year. But they did find some people who were pretty upset with what had happened with their plans, inexpensive, high-deductible plans that were no longer available. Is there any indication at this point that they're going to be able to find something similar on the exchange now that there is some more competition?
You know, there are bronze-level plans or catastrophic-level plans for individuals, you know, 30 and under, that provide just that very minimal level of coverage. But again, we're encouraging everybody to take a look at the plans that are on the marketplace because there is more competition this time around. Financial assistance is available. And really, the plans that are on the marketplace, you know, include those 10 essential benefits. You know, I like to say, when you think about what it means to have quality, affordable health coverage, it means you have access to maternity care and prescriptions are covered, emergency room visits, well visits, things like that are now, you know, afforded to everybody because of the Affordable Care Act.
But are there some options out there for people who are relatively healthy and perhaps don't qualify for those health care subsidies to still find health care plans that might be suitable to them and yet not terribly expensive?
Again, you know, with the financial assistance that we saw last year, you know, 62% of all consumers that enrolled qualified for a plan $100 or less. So, you know, I haven't been on the marketplace to look at all the price points for the plans here in Kalamazoo County, but I believe that, you know, there is going to be a plan that's out there and available for folks that meets their needs and their budget.
Does open enrollment have anything to do with Medicaid expansion in Michigan, or is that a separate thing and can people get Medicaid at different times?
Sure. Our Medicaid expansion program is known as Healthy Michigan, and that is an open enrollment program that's open to consumers year-round. And so it's separate from the marketplace. It has its own website, and consumers are encouraged if they believe that they qualify for Healthy Michigan, that they go to that website for more information.
Aaron, from your standpoint, how different does this time around with open enrollment this year feel from last year?
I think what we're experiencing right now is that there's still a hungry appetite amongst consumers to take a look at the marketplace. You know, our biggest challenge is assuring folks that financial assistance is available, but we know that of the folks that didn't enroll last time, 40%, actually 42% have indicated to us that they plan on enrolling before February 15th.
Aaron Knott, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Aaron Knott is the Michigan Director for Enroll America. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.